This is Friday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, Turkey says it downed an aircraft belonging to another country inside its territory. We'll explore that story with VOA's Pentagon correspondent. There is continuing violence in Israel.
It seems clear that the Palestinian leadership, at least the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, has very little control.
You'll hear the prognosis for the violence to at least be curtailed. And tonight we'll most likely see yet another barrier put up to the on the path to Western Europe by thousands of migrants. It's all ahead. Stay with us. Turkey says it has shot down an aircraft of unknown nationality that had intruded into its airspace near the Syrian border. In a statement, Turkey's military said the plane ignored three warnings before a Turkish warplane shot it down on Friday. Joining us from the Pentagon is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what's the latest on this?
Well, the latest is there has still not been any confirmation from other countries on exactly whose drone this is. The United States, the Pentagon was just telling us today that it was a drone, according to Turkey. It was unrecognized at the time, but the United States has said that all of their drones and all of their aircraft are accounted for. So some of the assumptions that are going around, while the Pentagon has not been able to confirm anything, has been that this could either be Syrian or this could be Russian. And as we know, Russia has already violated the airspace of Turkey twice, and Turkey has said that if any Russian or Syrian aircraft go over their border, they have the right to shoot it down.
Now, this thing came down, whatever it is, and from wherever it came, went down on Turkish territory. So the assumption here is that they are able, are the Turks, to go and take a look at it and try to investigate what it was and why it was there.
Yes, and that is why the United States and the coalition are waiting patiently for Turkey to take the lead on this. It was brought down, according to the Turks, about 3 kilometers inside of the airspace with the Syrian border. So this wasn't just a little diving in and diving out. This was significant enough to where the aircraft should have known that it was out of the Syrian airspace. This has happened before. Some of the Syrian jets have been shot down in the past by Turkey. Turkey has a very clear stance on the Syrian regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They think he should go, and they are not happy with what Russia is doing, trying to bolster Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. As you've noticed, most of the airstrikes by the Russians have been in areas that are held by the moderate opposition that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is trying to regain, not areas held by the Islamic State.
Now, Russia and Turkey, we have learned, have had some kind of communications over just this issue over the past couple of days. Is that correct?
That is correct. Turkey warned Russia and said, your aircraft cannot cross into our border. It could be shot down. This was just earlier this month. And there have also been some other scares with the Caspian Sea. The Russian military fired some missiles that went over Iran, Iraq, and into Syria. That caused a big to-do with the coalition, because the coalition said, hey, we have pilots in this airspace. When it went over Iraq, U.S. officials said that they were not notified that this was happening, and that's a common courtesy that the United States, the Pentagon, and Russian military officials are trying to work out now with the safety of the pilots, because had one of those missiles hit a U.S. or coalition aircraft doing their job in Iraq, that would have had a serious consequence.
Well, it remains to be seen what happens from here. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The Israeli army reports that a Palestinian man posing as a journalist was shot dead after he stabbed and wounded an Israeli soldier outside of the West Bank settlement of Kiryat Arba on Friday. This knife attack occurred while demonstrators threw stones at the Israeli troops. The man, disguised in a fluorescent yellow vest over a T-shirt that was marked press, was allowed to approach troops. News photos posted online show him clutching a knife and attacking a soldier before he was shot dead. The Foreign Press Association in Israel branded the attack as a deplorable, worrying development and a violation of press privilege. Media reports say the 20-year-old soldier was hospitalized with moderate stab wounds to his back and his shoulder. This is but the latest in a series of such violent instances in Israel recently. Joining us on International Edition is Stephen A. Cook. He's Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations. Stephen, thank you for being with us. Give us a little background. What's led to this latest rash of violence?
Well, this violence has been going on for about a month now, although it's intensified over the course of the last couple of weeks. And it seems that the spark for it has been an increasing effort on the part of Israelis, radical settlers, others to access the Temple Mount, where the Haram al-Sharif now stands, and to pray there. The Israeli government was permitting this, and then sporadic protests against it broke out, and then the Israeli government prohibited it from happening. But by this time, there's been a spiral of violence related to this flashpoint.
Is there any coordination here, or is it all still sporadic, do you think?
Well, it is subject, obviously, to debate, but it seems clear that the Palestinian leadership, at least the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, has very little control over Palestinians in Jerusalem and elsewhere who are stabbing Israelis randomly. It is a worrying sign because it doesn't seem that there is a real security response to this. You can't build walls when people are just randomly stabbing people on buses, on streets, and wherever. Obviously, today's attack near Hebron, near the Israeli settlement of Kiryat Arba, is on Israeli soldiers. One can assume that Israeli soldiers are in the occupied territories and elsewhere are always going to be a target. But what we've seen mostly in this recent wave of attacks are Palestinians with Israeli citizenship attacking Israelis throughout Israel, not necessarily just on the West Bank.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, says he is open for talks with Palestinian leader Abbas. Is there any hope there for this to come true? And even if it did, would this mean anything?
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu seems suddenly interested in talks with the Palestinian president. It seems unclear to me what exactly the Israeli leadership believes that they can achieve through talks. Of course, they have been blaming Abbas, and Abbas is not without responsibility here, having used a significant amount of inflammatory language when it came to Israelis being on the Haram al-Sharif, or as Israelis and Jews call it, the Temple Mount. Overall, it does not strike me, and for a long time, it's been the case that there is real no opportunity for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The structure of the conflict itself would indicate that we'll have stalemate for a long time to come.
Which has been a stalemate for a long time anyway. But,
exactly.
How does this come to an end? How do you at least curtail violence if you are on one side or the other?
Well, what we've seen in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are these periodic spasms of violence. From time to time, we have had Israeli incursions into the Gaza Strip. But if we take the intifadas as a template, what generally happens is the Palestinians grow exhausted, and it produces some sort of political change within Palestinian society that brings the violence to an end. But, of course, these things have gone on for years.
Well, again, it looks like we are where we started with just more violence. What is the outlook for some kind of settlement here, for some kind of agreement? U.S. Secretary of State Curry says he is on his way there soon. Is there anything he can do? And what about the talks?
In a word, the outlook for peace is bleak.
Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations. I guess that's the way it is. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
It's time on International Edition to check what is happening as far as social media and other digital media is concerned. Charlie Hansler joins us. What's on top of everything? What's trending the most today, Charlie?
Well, Ira, when people on Twitter are discussing Turkey shooting down that alien drone it alleges invaded its airspace near the Syrian border, the hashtag people most seem to be using is simply hashtag Turkey. In the past 3 hours, hashtag Turkey has been mentioned in tweets over 3,000 times, according to Topsy.com, a social media analytics website. Twitter users wanting to know better the details of this incident can check out Voice of America's story on the issue at our Twitter handle, @VOA News, where we tweeted, hashtag Turkey shoots down alleged Russian drone that crossed into its airspace near hashtag Syria, with a link to our story on the subject.
What else is trending as far as stories are concerned?
Well, today marks World Food Day, an international celebration to mark the global fight against hunger. Accordingly, hashtag World Food Day is garnering a whole lot of traffic on Twitter today, with nearly 7,000 uses of that hashtag on Twitter in the past hour alone, according to Topsy.com. Lastly, today marks literary icon Oscar Wilde's 161st birthday, so there are quite a few people on social media talking about him. Wilde is most well known for his classic novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, about a man who doesn't age, but where a magical self-portrait of his does.
Charlie Hansler with us on social media. Thanks, Charlie. Thanks for being with us. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Later this year, the 2.1-meter telescope at Arizona's Kitt Peak Observatory will be enhanced with an advanced optical device that will allow astronomers to gather incredibly detailed astronomical images. Called the RoboAO, the device is the world's first robotic laser-adaptive optics system. AO, short for adaptive optics, is a technology that improves image resolution by recognizing and correcting any visual distortion caused by atmospheric turbulence. The laser is an ultraviolet laser that projects an artificial guide star in the sky. The artificial guide star is used by the system to measure the actual amount of atmospheric blurring. These measurements are then fed into the robo or robotic adaptive optics system that removes optical distortion and produces a much sharper image. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. Jets from a Saudi-led military coalition bombed the House of Yemen's Speaker of Parliament on Friday, all part of a wave of attacks aimed at influential politicians. Residents of the Houthi-controlled capital Sana'a reported about 60 coalition airstrikes over the past 2 days on military bases, along with houses belonging to family members of Ali Abdullah Saleh, former president and an important ally of the Houthis. International Edition's senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi is with us, and he's been following the UN efforts to bring the warring sides to negotiate an end to this conflict. Mohammed, again, thanks for being with us. The UN has been trying to convince the two sides that there is no military solution to the conflict. What's new about this now?
Sometimes, Ira, bad news brings some hope. Because according to Deputy UN Secretary General Jan Eliasson, the latest advances by Al-Qaeda terrorist group benefiting from the conflict in Yemen have made the need for the talks more pressing than ever.
There's very strong logic for the talks to start because, as I said, you have Al-Qaeda gaining from it, you have a tremendous human suffering, and you will have huge problems of reconciliation and repair and reparations coming. So the logic is there. There is a need for the talks. There has been some question raised not only by the Houthis but also by the Hadi government about the talks and skepticism about starting the talks. I would just appeal to both sides and to all countries who can influence the parties that they really now should not miss this opportunity.
The UN official acknowledged that there is a continuous mistrust between the warring parties, but the Houthis announced they are committed to a UN-backed peace plan, and he said that was a positive development.
Yeah, but so far this Saudi-led coalition seems to be tempted to storm the Houthi-held Yemeni capital by force. What about that?
It seemed that way, Ira, but U.S. former ambassador to Yemen, Steve Sesh, said that would be a grave mistake, leading only to more human loss and the destruction of the infrastructure in the capital. He recommended a U.S. push for a negotiated settlement.
Well, we don't have a lot of leverage. What I would use is the little leverage we have. If the Saudis do want a brand new supply of modern weaponry, we sit down with them and say, if you need this, we need to find out how can you bring this to a negotiated end. What can be a resolution that's not going to depend upon a military solution? And what is going to be a negotiation? What's it going to look like? Who's going to be at the table and who is going to be willing to make a concession? Neither party at the moment, I believe, is prepared to make the important concession.
Ambassador Sesh said the Saudi-led coalition should not assume that the Houthis and their allies have to surrender before the talks can be started.
Once again, Mohammed, thanks for being with us and thanks for this update.
Thank you, Ira, for having me.
The program is International Edition, and this is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Nominations for the 2015 American Music Awards have been announced. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joined International Edition's Sarah Williams and talked about the country music nominees.
Award season is upon us, and the Country Music Association Awards released their nominees about a month back. And just this week, the American Music Association announced their selection. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to weigh in on how country music fared. Well, Nikki, were there any surprises for country music in particular at the AMAs this year?
Yes, there were surprises. So aside from the basic country music categories like favorite male and female country artist of the year, country music had nominees in two other coveted categories, which was Artist of the Year and New Artist of the Year. Luke Bryan was nominated again this year for Artist of the Year, and Sam Hunt, who has the most, he's the country artist with the most nominations, he is up for New Artist of the Year. And last year, the AMAs did not have any country artist in that category. So I think it really speaks to his crossover appeal and success he's had this year.
Well, what do you think are the chances for Sam Hunt or Luke Bryan to win in either of those categories?
Well, the AMAs are determined by online voting. So right now there are 10 nominees for Artist of the Year, and that's going to be narrowed down to 5 on November 11th based on fan votes. So Luke Bryan was in the final list last year. Hopefully he will make it again this year. He's up against Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Nicki Minaj, Sam Smith, to name a few, and they have ferocious social media followings. We all know how popular Taylor Swift is.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And as far as Sam Hunt is concerned, like Luke Bryan, he has some pretty stiff competition. So he's going up against The Weeknd, who has made history on the charts, as well as the very popular group Walk the Moon and Tove Lo. So like Luke Bryan, his fans are really going to have to show up and vote, especially in light of The Weeknd's tremendous success this year.
Any word or rumor as to which country artists will be performing?
Ah, not yet. Last year, Luke Bryan introduced Garth Brooks live from Garth's concert in North Carolina. And so will Sam Hunt or Carrie Underwood or even Blake Shelton introduce someone else? That has yet to be seen.
When do the AMAs air and where can people vote?
Well, November 22nd, it airs live on the ABC network, and people can vote at amavote.com. I already voted.
Okay. You got that message out there, so make sure you vote.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at VOA underscore music or on Facebook at simply VOA Music. You can also catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA One. Thanks very much, Nikki.
Thank you.
Have a good time. I'm gonna bring the good time home to you. We'll have a house party. We don't need nobody. Turn your TV off. Break that boombox out. We'll wake up.
t-shirt over the lampshade. I'll take the furniture and slide it out of the way. Shaking the floor, rattling the roof. We'll go to town right there in your living room. Let's have a
We have a final story for you. You bet, might not have known that today is World Food Day. And calling hunger a terrible injustice, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon journeyed to Italy with a visit to the Milan Expo World's Fair, which is focused on food security and nutrition, bidding to invigorate a global commitment to eradicating hunger by 2030. Ban called for a pledge for food security for all the people around the world to build a global movement to end hunger. This will go hand in hand with greater health, economic development, and social inclusion for individuals and societies, he said. That is our program for this day. We thank you very much for being with us. Please visit our website at voanews.com. All kinds of good, interesting, neat, and in-depth stuff in there. My name is Ira Melman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its latest annual human rights report, the U.S. State Department has called attention to the Iranian government's practice of denying necessary medical treatment to certain prisoners. Ahmed Shahid, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran, has also cited this violation, as have the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture and several human rights monitors. Political prisoners appear to be particular targets, and human rights organizations have highlighted particular cases of such abuse. On September 13th, labor activist Shahrokh Zamani died at the infamous Rajai Shahr prison in Karaj, where he was serving an 11-year sentence for his peaceful activities on behalf of workers. The International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran reported that he died from a stroke days after prison authorities refused him medical treatment. In August, journalist and human rights activist Narges Mohammadi was taken to a hospital in Tehran from Evin prison, where she is serving a 6-year sentence for alleged crimes against national security. Amnesty International reports that since August, Mohammadi, who has a history of seizures and loss of vision, has been denied treatment by a specialist, and even when prison doctors insisted she be hospitalized and stressed the need for further treatment, she was returned to prison. Omid Kokabi is a postdoctoral Iranian laser physicist at the University of Texas at Austin, who has been imprisoned since 2011 after returning to Iran to visit family. He is serving a 10-year prison term after being convicted on charges of communicating with a hostile government. He said he was jailed for refusing to cooperate with Iranian military projects. Recently, his mother wrote a letter to Iran's supreme leader calling for her son's freedom. She also noted that after 5 years in prison, her son is suffering from a series of medical maladies, including stomach and kidney ailments, for which he is being denied outside medical treatment despite the prison doctor's recommendation. In jailing these three citizens, the Iranian government has failed to uphold its own laws and international obligations that guarantee fundamental human rights. The denial of adequate medical care during their detention constitutes further and dangerous abuse. Iran must cease its denial of appropriate medical care for prisoners and, at a minimum, uphold basic international standards for their treatment.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.